much for coming in to do the interview. I just had a look through your bio and there's just so much that you have done already. You've got your doctorate, you still teach at the university and you still work and do clinical time, is that right?
Well yes, ish. So I don't teach regularly at the university anymore because the travel just became so much that wasn't really feasible. So I'll do one class in the spring and then one class in the fall and the autumn. And then the clinic is just 2 days a week. So
that still sounds pretty full on. Where do you find the energy for all of that?
Well, I firmly believe if you're going to teach or talk about something, you need to be in the trenches doing it as well. So as long as I'm talking about it, I think I'll be treating as well.
So where did it all start for you, Lisa? How did it come about, your sort of journey to become a pediatric physical therapist?
Pediatrics? Well, human body functioning had always interested me. And actually, I was supposed to be a physical education major. That's what I wanted to do. And was kind of just, getting the prerequisite classes for that. And people kept saying to me, you need to do physical therapy. That's where the money is. Which back in the 90s, when this conversation was happening, it was pretty good money, but that's not the same anymore. But I was idealistic and I didn't want to choose a career just for the money. Oh boy, if I could go back and talk to my 20-year-old self. But anyway, so I didn't want to just do it for the money. But I was actually looking at some kind of work advertising or career poster one day. And one of the fastest growing fields was physical therapy. So I went to a local hospital and spent a couple of days with one of the therapists there and just and loved it. And so that was kind of where it started, but had no intention of working with children at all. My husband and I, we've been married 25 years. We chose not to have children. I didn't want to work with other people's children. It was not supposed to be pediatrics. It was hand therapy. That's what I wanted to do.
Hand therapy?
Yep.
That was, okay. That's what I wanted to do. Yeah. Right. Yeah. And so then?
I was going to say, so there's the inevitable next question. So then I did have a job in hand therapy for a year and really did like it. It's very detail oriented. It's very, very specific and highly skilled. And, if people can't use their hands, it's a big difference in their lives. And so I really enjoyed it. But just as life does sometimes, financially, that company was not in the best position and I was laid off. So a friend of mine had actually been given a job in pediatrics and she'd accepted it, but then she found out she was pregnant and was fortunate enough not to have to work. And so I took her job at the pediatric clinic with the complete intention. I remember thinking to myself, well, I'll just do this until something better comes along. Over 20 years ago now, so still waiting for something better to come along, I think.
Such an interesting journey. So it just kind of, you kind of fell into it, really.
Oh, for sure. And it's interesting though, I still think, like I said about the hand therapy, I think pediatrics is the same. It's very detailed, it's very precise. You change their life one way or the other, depending on, the success of the outcomes, and highly skilled. So I guess what drew me to the hand therapy was also the same for pediatrics.
So why toe walking? How did that grab your attention?
Oh, goodness, I didn't choose that either, I tell you. No, didn't want to do that either. I think with the toe walking, like everybody, we were just seeing more and more in our clinic, and we weren't having a whole lot of success with it. It wasn't an enjoyable diagnosis for anybody. The kids didn't like coming to therapy. We were not making a big difference. And as anyone who knows me, I don't fail well. And I was failing. But I also did keep kind of complaining. And I heard myself say repeatedly, someone needs to find a better way to do this. Somebody needs to find a better way to do this. And I feel that you can only say that for so long, somebody needs to, before you either need to stop complaining or you need to be that somebody. And so that's kind of how that started, was just frustration with what was out there already.
Right. Yeah. There's a lot of areas of pediatrics, though, that perhaps we're not as effective as we'd like to be. I'm just wondering where that toe walking, why that grabbed you more than other areas, really.
I think I probably like the logic of biomechanics.
Right.
You put this bone here, put that bone there, and then you can pretty much predict what the muscle will do. I certainly liked that. Like I say, the logic of it and the specificity appeals to me. I also think that the more I learned about the foot, which I spent a lot of time with Billy, with Beverly Cusick. She's a good friend of mine. And the more I learned about the foot, the more in awe of it I was, quite frankly. And so those two things kind of came together, that the foot was just an incredible piece of machinery to me. And again, very logical and easy to structurally understand. And again, an area that we have a big deficit in with children's feet and children's gait. I just think we're missing the mark many times as health professionals in general.
You talked about Billy as being somebody that really influenced you. Who sort of influenced your foundation knowledge around physical therapy and biomechanics and that sort of thing?
Well, I think that I was very fortunate in that when I first graduated, I was a PT assistant, actually. And when I first graduated, I was real fortunate to work with a physical therapist who was not only excellent, but also had very high standards herself and held me to those standards, and then also encouraged me in that regard. And so it was kind of a natural progression, really. If I'm going to work at this place with this supervisor, then you know, you become as good as you can be. So I really got a good foundation there. And then just in general, where I live, I kind of felt that maybe I'd hit a little bit of my ceiling, or maybe I just wanted to go in a different direction. And that's when I sought out Billy. Yes. The first time we met, actually, I went out to her home in Telluride for 10 days. And it was just her and I. And the goal was that she would teach me. She asked me what I wanted, and I said, I want you to teach me everything you know, which, you know, 10 days, as long as she's been doing that, I don't know if that was quite manageable. So she narrowed it down. She had me write some objectives, but that's pretty much what we did. It was a good, I'd say, easily average of 10 hours a day for those 10 days that we talked biomechanics and feet and function.
So just the two of you?
Yes, just the two of us and a projector on the wall. Yep, for 10 days.
That's amazing.
It was fun. You know, I knew going out, because I knew about Billy, and I knew at the beginning of that it would change my career and it would change my professional life, no doubt about it. What I didn't know is that it would, that I would make such a good friend and it would change my life in that way. So that was definitely an unexpected bonus for sure.
So you're quite sort of driven to chase knowledge and improve your own skills, it sounds like.
I think so.
When did you do your PhD amongst all of this?
Well, and just to clarify, I started out on the PhD track. Just to clarify, it's not a big deal. The ultimate degree is actually a DPT, a clinical doctorate.
Right.
You know, and that's probably the answer to that question is also why I don't have the PhD. I felt that that's what everybody else was doing. I felt that, you know, to keep up with everybody else, that's what I needed to do. I also wanted to teach in a physical therapy program. But as with all things that are challenging, sometimes you learn a lot about yourself. And teaching in a conventional setting in a physical therapy program with those parameters is not for me. I'm glad we have people that do that. It's just not where I'm supposed to be. I think it's not where I'm happiest. And similar with the research, you know, I wish I wanted to do research. I really, because I think it can really make changes. I've just got into it multiple times. And bottom line is I just don't like it. I just, for a variety of reasons. And again, thank goodness there are people out there doing that. So then when it came down to commitment time, do I followed through. I got all the education for the PhD and some wonderful, wonderful professors. And then I had to choose, do I continue on this path or do I switch to a clinical emphasis and get back in the clinic? And that's what I chose to do.
Yeah. It's quite interesting, isn't it? Because the clinical skills and the academic skills and the research skills are quite different.
Mm-hmm. I would agree. I would agree. I think primarily it's because we're all a product of what we know. One of the mistakes we made was we started out with a real move towards evidence-based practice, which is client values, clinical expertise, and scientific research. And somewhere along the line, it became research-based practice. The insurance companies in our healthcare system probably have a lot to do with that. However, I think it's a shame it went from evidence-based to research-directed, and that's where we lost some of the application and focus mostly on the research, I think. And it doesn't always transfer to the clinic, certainly not with children.
No, it doesn't. I agree. So I know you've done the ACT, which is the assessment criteria for toe walking. Is that right?
Yep. Uh-huh.
Has anybody taken up that to sort of look at it as a research tool, or is that something you'd like to go down that road with?
Yes. Yes is the answer to both those questions. Yeah, definitely. We have there's two universities at the moment, and the research is not in one of them. It's just in the beginning stages. One, the pilot study has been completed, and now they're going to the more of the clinical trials. But the pilot study was really interesting. The results of that came out that they compared traditional stretching, AFOs, those kind of things with therapy. And then they looked at more of the etiology perspective, which is what I prefer to do. And they found the two primary influencing factors that improved the outcome was when they addressed vestibular deficiencies and visual problems, both of which I'm firmly believed are a strong component in toe walking. So it was kind of exciting that some of the data came out to support those two things. And the other one, we're looking at surface EMGs to see the degree of activation of the abdominal muscles and the glutes when you truly do put contact through the heel. So that's, yeah, and I'd love to. I am open to participating in research for sure, and guiding and being a part of the process. It's I enjoy it. I just don't want to be the sole or the primary leader.
That's really exciting. Where did you say that research has been done?
They've actually asked me to not say that at the moment. It's two universities in the United States, but just because they're in the preliminary stages and they haven't had, you know, a full disclosure yet, they just want to keep their name out of it at the moment.
Okay. Well, we'll just have to watch that space. That's very exciting.
Right, exactly. But you, as soon as it's official, boy, I will plaster it all over. That's for certain.
I bet. So what would you say is the biggest misconception people have about toe walking after they've done your course? So where do people get it wrong?
The misconception they have after? You mean like when they realize, yeah, Oh, maybe I've been looking at this slightly inaccurate?
So, yeah, well, because obviously doing your course changes a big part of the picture for a lot of therapists. I know I did your course and it was just really enlightening. But you come away from the course and you maybe pick up bits and bobs of it. And then when you sort of try and apply it back home in the clinic, there's often stuff that you just maybe are missing. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Actually, somebody else said that to me, and they've created a Facebook page for exactly that reason. I have nothing to do with it, but people go on who've taken the course and say, what did she say about that? Or why am I, what is this, you know, why is this not gelling? So that's called, what is that called? A step in the right direction.
Right.
Yeah, and Angela Rafferty started that. So there's, I don't know, it's a support group for people who survived my course, maybe. But I think the primary is that we intuitively, and also what we've been taught, we believe that toe walking is a foot and ankle problem. We might have some underlying thoughts that there's other systems involved or there's weakness, or we think it might be sensory, but we kind of think it's a foot and ankle problem. And I think as soon as we can change our view and start looking at toe walking as a movement disorder, and therefore consider all of the body systems that are involved in movement and rehabilitating from that perspective, I think that can maybe correct some of the misconceptions. The other one is that these kids are strong. Oh my gosh, look at their muscle mass. Oh, look at their calves. They must be so strong. They can do that all day. And that's usually quite the opposite. It's not strength at all. It's actually incredible weakness and also poor isolation. They're just not sure which muscles to activate when. And the motor maps are just not there.
Yeah. Yeah. So do you have therapists coming back to you with questions after the course?
I do. And that is where day three came from. Primarily the questions were about vision, shoe modification, and some reflexes. So day three came about, which we've now got on a webinar. So that's kind of cool. People can, if they want a refresher, they can go back and they can watch day three, which is not a repeat of what one and two are. It's more of a continuation, actually, an expansion. But they do. And I want that. I want people to come to me and for me to help them to think it through. The tricky part is, I think therapists, if you can come to me with most of the mental work done already, then that's helpful. Because, you know, you still have to see the child and that kind of thing. So I'm happy to do like a 10-15 minutes consultation. And then after that, it becomes more of a private consultation. And then I have to charge for it. This is my income. But they do come back with questions. But it's interesting. It tends to be more, the therapists know. They know what they need to do. So the questions tend to be more of a confirmation that they're looking for, a verification of, am I on the right track? So it's cool. And I tell you, I'm really impressed. Not surprised, but very impressed and very excited with the amount of therapists who've taken this in many countries, not just here, who've taken it on their own and really done a lot of good with it. So it's very easy to duplicate and carry over, I think.
Yeah, I do think that's partly due to the way you teach it. It's very easy to follow on from your course and to just take that information and apply it practically. So I think that's a big part of just how you present the information, which is great. How long have you been doing teaching with the toe walking, Lisa?
Probably started about 7 years ago because I have other courses. That's just the one that everybody wants for obvious reasons. Right. But I started about 7 years ago, and it was just a development of gait and posture. When we got to the toe walking segment, I had, you know, maybe 10 minutes or so for that diagnosis. And it just became just a talking point. And then that became 20 minutes and 30 minutes. And so I just found that there was more and more, and that's what people wanted. And then the company I was with, their business model was one day. And so I'm still on good terms with them, but I moved away and went to work with another company. So then it became the 2 days. The 3 days was good for a long time. It's very cost prohibitive for both people and for speakers and companies.
So what got you into that sort of mode of teaching? Because that's different to teaching at a university or an undergrad program.
Yeah. Well, teaching was my retirement plan, to be honest. I had a friend who was about 10 years older than me and had pretty, she was an occupational therapist and had pretty bad arthritis in her shoulders, just from, you know how we are. We're on our hands and knees. We're swinging children. We're grabbing children, you know, and it's very physical what we do. And so she was really having a hard time with just functioning. And she said to me, I don't know what else to do. And then I thought, gosh, that's going to be me as well, you know. And I went to school in America, so I have incredible school loans. I'm going to be paying those things off long after my house is paid off. And so I knew I had to keep working. And I knew I had to keep working. So I thought, well, I'll teach, you know, because as long as I've got my brains, I can sit and do that. So I applied at the local university here, just wanted to teach medical terminology. And that's pretty easy. It's basic. You know, it wasn't too, I was afraid to teach. I was very afraid to teach. I had a friend who tried to talk me out of it. He said that it's nowhere near as, you know, what you think it is. It's very disappointing. So I went to medical terminology. It felt safe. And I came out of the interview agreeing to teach anatomy. So that was quite a shift. So I did that. And I was more surprised than anybody that, you know, I wasn't as bad as I thought I was going to be. I was really surprised about that, to be honest. And then it just evolved from there. I enjoy it. I really do enjoy it. And you know, it seems to be working for now. So, but it was a mistake as well. Lots of things in my life I've seemed to have fallen into.
It sounds like it. Did you say it was a mistake, or just that it was a sort of just something that just happened that you were planning?
It wasn't intentional. I should say it wasn't intentional.
What are your favorite therapy books?
You know, I'm sitting here now in my office, which I can kind of cheat because I can look around and see. I'll tell you, I never thought I would say this, but the ones I really get a kick out of now are the sensory processing dysfunction books.
Right.
And again, I never thought I'd be down that road because I am very literal and logical, and sensory processing doesn't quite fall with those adjectives. But I just found, again, that's such a huge component with these kids that walk on their toes that we're missing. And the more I learned about that, the more it interested me. Neurology was always interesting. And so the neuro component of brain plasticity and sensory processing dysfunction, as well as the rehabilitation, is really interesting. But I think, you know, the books that I really can't put down medical wise are the ones that are written by people with autism. I say it all the time. There's many books written about autism. You really don't want to know about it, read a book written by someone with autism.
Can you give me a name or two?
Do you know, I knew you were going to say that.
Sorry.
Every time I mention this in class, I can't remember. Robert Keane, or maybe McKean. K-E-A-N-E is one. And he writes Soon Will Come the Light. And he's an adult now, but he was actually institutionalized because, you know, they felt that he was mentally ill. His is very interesting. And then also Look Me in the Eye. And I can't remember who wrote that one. But Look Me in the Eye is eye-opening, but it is. You know, and Temple Grandin was where I kind of got my feet wet.
If you were talking to a therapist that was just newly into this field, what would you recommend as a starting point?
Well, a starting point, I think that Jenny Brack is an OT, but she does a very good job of explaining and then giving treatment interventions for kids with sensory processing dysfunction. So we don't get very much of that in school, but it's what we see. We can't avoid it. And so Jenny Brack has a course called Ready, Set, Go. And then she also has courses on MedBridge. And MedBridge is a pretty good deal financially wise. You can get a variety of courses. And then, you know, the kinesiotaping courses are also really good. It's just such a good tool. And it applies to many situations, there's a lot of carryover. So I think for survival, I'd take one of Jenny's courses.
Right.
Black, yep. And then for clinical skills, I think I would take a taping course, a pediatric specific taping course for sure. And then, you know, when you're ready for it, 3-4 years in, and you've got your head around this therapy thing, then I'd take one of Billy's. But you've got to have a good foundation in order for that not to be overwhelming. It's well worth it, but right out of school, I think that might be a little tough.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. Having just not so recently done her course, it's really heavy going.
The information is just excellent, and it really, like I said, it accelerated my career in the course of a week or two. But you gotta have a handle on your bases first, I think, on your foundation.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you weren't a physical therapist, what would you be doing?
Travel magazine, for sure. Something for a travel magazine. I'm fortunate that I've been able to travel into physical therapy.
Right.
But gosh, I love it. I love travel, different languages, different cultures, different food. And so if something happened, I'd have to change careers. That would be it, I think.
So where's the most interesting place you've been?
Oh, well, of course. you know, people ask me that a lot because I do get to travel so much. And I mean, I don't want to give the cliche answer that everywhere is different and everywhere has its value. And it does, it really does. But I think if I had to, if I really had to narrow it down, it would be Istanbul, Turkey.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Because it's so unlike anything I've ever experienced. And many places are very different, but that is so far removed from anything that I knew and the people. Although the more people I meet, the more I realize we're alike than we are different. But there, yeah. Meeting the people and just the lifestyle and the daily things. It was, yeah, I'd say Istanbul. And I'd love to go back there.
So do you organize your own courses or is that done through a company that you work with?
It's both.
Okay.
The company that I work with has a further reaching marketing potential. So they do the behind the scenes work that I don't necessarily love, but they're in the United States only. And then the other stuff I'll arrange either with a company overseas, like Milestones in Sydney, or people just contact me directly and I'll work it out with them. I've done that several times as well. So, yeah.
So there were a few questions that people sent through. Do you have them in front of you?
If I was prepared, I would, wouldn't I? Let me.
That's okay. Do you want me to read them out to you?
Yes. Why don't you do that? And I will find them. Found them. I got them. Here we go.
Okay.
So you want to ask me the first one.
Okay. So if there is one muscle to trial kinesiotaping trial, which one would it be with a student with autism and idiopathic toe walking?
With autism and idiopathic toe walking, I would do what I refer to as heel seating, which is essentially a joint compression technique that goes on the inferior aspect of the heel and then pulls up over the malleoli. So you're giving compression. If the child's prone, then it would be downward pressure, but the pressure goes from distal to proximal. And that gives proprioceptive input to the heel, and that can sometimes be effective with autism because it increases awareness to and grounding and proprioceptive input to a body part that maybe doesn't have that strong of a motor map for them.
So are you putting the tape medial to lateral?
No, it would be, and that's, like I say, that's not a muscle, but that's the tape. No, it goes, if you think of almost like putting on a sock, you would pull on both sides, equal pressure, either side of the malleoli and along the plantar surface of the heel. So it's one piece that pulls up.
Okay.
I usually do it with them prone though, with their knee bent and pushed down. It just seems to be a little easier that way.
Thank you. So the next question is, once achieving heel strike with modified shoes with wedges, how long before would you recommend daily walking practice before starting to slowly decrease wedges?
Okay. For me, the change in their range of motion guides it to a certain extent. And then also when I video them and I slow them down, I look at the tibial position. So those two factors kind of come into play as well. I mean, they can have great range of motion, but if the tibia is not coming forward, then I wouldn't reduce the wedge just yet. However, in general, you need about a month before you make significant changes, because sometimes the body can adapt very quickly and respond and it looks great. But then those results aren't sustained because we haven't done it long enough to establish the neurological components of it, the motor map, and then the muscle strength and the muscle balance. So I'd be cautious, maybe 3-4 weeks before you make changes.
Okay. So when you say you video them, do you video them with the modified shoes on or off?
Both. So I video with them on to make sure that the shoe is accommodating, or that the shoe's providing what I want, that the tibia is coming forward at about that anywhere from like 5 to 10, 12 degrees. And then I also video with them off, can compare it to the previous video with them off. And then I can see how, if the tibia has improved.
So what are you using to measure the change in the tibia angle?
Okay, and this is where I become a little unconventional because, you know, people like literal numbers. So
right.
I, probably because I've done it for so long, I look and I can get a really good idea of if it's improving, is it coming forward? But there's also on the, there's a lot of apps. Igonio is one. PT Tools is a good one. And you can take a video, slow it down and take a screenshot of them in mid-stride, so mid-stance. And take a screenshot, and then PT Tools will, and many other apps like that, will measure the actual angle.
Right.
So if you want literal documentation, and again, if you want to be accurate, that's a good one to do. And a lot of the apps will do that, but you need one that'll take a screenshot of them in mid stance.
And you personally, are you just judging it, eyeballing it, or do you actually measure it?
I assess it. you know, I use the term eyeball, and a lot of people do as well, and they ask me that. But it's a little more skilled than that. But I tend to do more assessment of it visually, to be honest, than measure. But I don't teach that, and I don't suggest that. I have seen hundreds and hundreds of kids walking on their toes, and I've seen many, many plans of care progress. So I recognize it. I think if you try to eyeball it in the beginning, you're going to get frustrated because you're not getting it accurately yet. So
it's a good way to start training your skills. You need that more definite measurement.
I think so. Because what you think you're seeing, then you get the measurement of, oh gosh, that's not at all what I thought, you know? So
yeah,
it's like with any range of motion. I think we had, remember in school you had to measure, but now you kind of, now you know what it looks like, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. So the next question says, hi, Lisa, I would love to know how you use your beautiful dog in your treatment sessions. What type of things does she do and how do the kids respond?
Oh, yes. Serendipity. She was actually barking about 4 or 5 minutes ago. I don't know if that came through, but we live in the country and she doesn't really bark that often until I'm doing something like this. And then she has to save us from the army of killer squirrels that are apparently advancing on the house. So anyway, I heard her doing that. Yes, serendipity. She's a sweetheart. And my friend who does the Facebook page does the Saturdays with Sarah. So a lot of people are familiar with her. She, you know, I knew that I wanted a therapy dog, but we've always rescued and raised and rehabilitated pit bulls. And just for the, you know, for the obvious social perspective, they were never good. So when I got this nice, cute little fluffy puppy, I was perfect therapy dog. And if anybody knows anything about border collies, they are very intelligent. There's no doubt about it. They say that they're have the intelligence of typically about a 5-year-old child. She really is incredibly smart. But along with intelligence comes independent thought, which doesn't always make for the best training. And so while she's a good therapy dog, a lot of what she does just comes from her decision, if she wants to, if she feels like it. So we did do agility training, so she can do that. So if she jumps over a hurdle, then the kids will do it too. If she can actually balance on a therapy ball too, which is really kind of cute. I think there's a video of that on Facebook. So then if she goes on a therapy ball, the kids do. If she runs through a tunnel, that's the kids do. Yeah, she's really pretty clever at that. So we did use that a lot as motivation. I had a little guy who hemiplegia, and he would brush her with his affected hand. Walking, she's a pretty big dog. She's pretty stable. So she's about 60, 65 pounds. And so kids will walk next to her or even lean on her. And she'll stand pretty steady. And so she was both motivation and then also a physical tool. What I didn't expect is the intuition that this dog has. That's what I really didn't. And I certainly didn't teach it to her. She will only to some people. She will back up and push and put pressure on kids. She'll also sit on their feet. She'll sit on their lap. If they're on the floor, she'll sit on them. I have hundreds of pictures of Serendipity sitting on kids. But I never taught her that. And she doesn't do it to everybody. the people right. that she does it to tend to be the kids who are maybe at higher arousal level, or kids that need calming, or kids that like compression. And I can't explain how she knows, but she just does. And then just an incredible calming effect. She's when we're out, she's just being a dog. She's very busy, and she runs with me. She's very active. But in the clinic, because I've trained her that way, she's very calm. I have one story, a little girl who had spinal cord tumor removed, and she had scar tissue. I was working on the scar tissue. And it was, you know, it was uncomfortable for sure. And Sarah jumped up on the bed with the girl, and I told her to get down. And she jumps up again, and I told her to get down. And, you know, border collies usually get their own way. So she lays up there. She lays up there with this little girl. And the girl looked at me, and she put her arm over Sarah. And she said to me, she said, "But it doesn't hurt when serendipity's up here with me."
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah.
So a lot of the stuff, I just kind of let her guide it. And she, yeah, so she does a variety of things. Some of it's specific tricks, and some of it she just takes upon herself.
Yeah. That's amazing. Okay, next question. Hi, Lisa. What is your success rate with younger children on the more extreme end of the autism spectrum?
I'm assuming success rate with toe walking, not with curing the autism.
I'm going to go with that. Yep.
Yeah, we'll go with that. Yeah. Success rate with younger children. The autism is tricky because it encompasses obviously the additional components of autism, and then also how well are those components addressed. But one thing, and I'll go back to that in a second, one thing I have learned is that the severity of the toe walking and the length of time and the contractures and the level of sensory involvement seem to have no bearing on the rate at which the kids improve. So I could have a kid that's highly involved and they improve very quickly. And then I can have kids where I think, oh, this is just musculoskeletal, this is a breeze, and it lasts forever. So it really, so younger, older, autism or not, doesn't really, that's kind of hard to group them in that, because I've had some that have done well and some that haven't. I would say though, as far as achieving success with young children, and then also with autism, I would say to address the biomechanics first, because everybody does better with improved biomechanics, whether it's someone like me who's doing yoga or whether it's a kid that walks on their toes. But the children, if they've been toe walking for any length of time, either have poor biomechanics, or that's what they had that was suffering in the first place, and that's where the toe walking came from. So I think with the younger kids, the sooner we can get them to improve the biomechanics while they're still developing those motor maps, that's where the success is going to be. Because you know, I don't know what they mean by younger, but by about three, our writing reactions are pretty well established. So heavy practice and changing the movement pattern that they practice in the younger kids is important.
So when you say improve biomechanics, are you talking about more sort of things you can apply, like the kinesiotaping and the theratogs or the orthotics or shoe raises? Right. Are those the kind of things you're meaning?
Yeah, exactly. Where you affect alignment and all of those things I use that you just suggested. Yeah, that's what I mean by biomechanics is putting the foot, the ankle, the leg, the hip, the trunk in the ideal position for stability during gait, and then practicing that stability,
and then practicing it with activities that you give the parents to do at home.
Yes.
Okay. So, what sort of? I don't know if this is a question that's easy to answer. It's a general question, but how often do you see kids in your therapy clinic?
Yeah, if because this does come up. So, if all right, on average, I see kids about once a month. Now, that, again, has come because of travel, because of my schedule, or because I can figure out quickly with some kids what needs to be done, and then that's all they need. But I think probably more what people really want to know when they ask me that is, how often is intervention happening, you know? So I tell my parents at the beginning, when we have the evaluation and we have the talk, I tell them, you're going to need to do something. Something needs to be done about 5 days a week. Now, you can come to see me twice a week and do the rest of it at home those 3 days. You could, you know, do it at home 4 or 5 days a week yourself and then come to see me every couple of weeks. Or you could see me once a month and then follow up with your other therapist once a week and then you do things. But there needs to be some type of movement practice, in my opinion, pretty much daily. And daily's not really practical and feasible. So that's where I come with the 5 days. 5 days is doable.
Right.
So I see them when we do therapy and therapeutic activities and that kind of thing. But a big part of what I do is the assessment and the determination and I have the skill of what needs to be done, but the practical carryover that needs to be done at home.
So what sort of length of time are you asking parents to do daily?
Usually 20 to 30 minutes, no more than 30. 30 minutes is usually the maximum for whatever I'm doing. And I change it every couple of weeks. You know, if you've ever worked out for any length of time, it gets boring.
It does get boring.
For most people, you know, and the same reasons that we don't work out, it's boring, it's inconvenient, I don't have time, I didn't plan, whatever, are the same reasons why parents don't do home programs. And so we might be doing abdominal strengthening for 4 weeks, but I might change the activity every week. So they do 4 different things. Quality, not quantity, but I think 30 minutes is possible and feasible in life. And you know, 15 to 20 is probably the minimum. So to get effects, to get benefits.
Right. My personal question is, when you see kids that, because there's a lot of questions about autism, but sometimes you see kids with really mild CP that are toe walking. Mm-hmm. How is your treatment different, or would you just apply the same principles?
No, it is slightly different. For me, the principles of the biomechanical alignment are still the same. The strengthening, the muscle balance, all of that is definitely the same. However, whereas with a kid that has an intact central nervous system, then the 20, 30 minutes of walking usually takes care of things pretty well. However, when the central nervous system is damaged or is affected, as in the case of CP, then I think the intervention needs to be longer, needs to be more intensive. And that might be, by intensive, I mean they might wear orthotics more of the day, or they may definitely get therapy once or twice a week in addition to what they're doing at home. So I think the intensity goes up a little bit more with that diagnosis, but the basic principles remain somewhat the same.
Okay, so if you're looking at a child that has a good range, but they have a catch at R1 that's less than 90, you would still put them in plantar flexion in wedged shoes?
Yes, I would. Yes, I would.
And then would you add anything extra to stretch out the TAs, or would you just follow the usual protocol?
To stretch out the anterior tib, that's what you mean, TA?
Tendo Achilles, sorry, gastroxoleus.
Oh, okay. See, that's where we have to be multilingual, because TA can be tibialis anterior, transversal. Yeah.
Sorry.
And then you guys also refer to TA as exactly. So I love it, though. That's one of the things I like about knowing different people. So I enjoy that. No, I'm not. I'm just not big on stretches. I feel that whatever the movement disorder is, you know, regardless of the diagnosis, a movement disorder develops, and we're talking about gait here, a movement disorder develops because of repetitive pathological movement. And so to improve it, we need to go down the same route of repetitive, but this time non-pathological movement. So the kids didn't get short muscles from us not stretching them. So to get longer muscles, I just don't feel that stretching it's just not the most beneficial approach. And again, I'm going to ask families to do something and children to do something. I want to get the most quality. I want to get where they're going to get the most they can out of their 20, 30 minutes. And so I'm not saying stretching is wrong. It's just not what I choose to do. So no, I probably wouldn't address that. I probably would focus more on movement.
That is a great answer. Is there anything else that you think we haven't covered that you would like therapists who are working with children that toe walk to know about?
Yeah. It takes me 2 days. So, but if, you know, until you can do that, I'd say don't be afraid to get out of the box. You know, most of the time I find that therapists say, I knew it wasn't because of tight heel cords. I knew it. And right. We're told by people with different degrees and different professions that, that we're wrong, or that's not right, or research says this, or research that says that. But, you know, we do have the luxury in our profession of trying something and not having, hopefully most of the time, terrible consequences. So if you think you want to give it a try, but it's not conventional, then, you know, then try it. Don't be afraid to get out of the box, because as pediatric therapists, we know we have to know about everything. We have to know cardio, respiratory, neurological. We have to know what happens if we need to do CPR right now. We have to know if that shunt is malfunctioning. We have to know about muscle balance, muscle strength, concentric, eccentric. So there's a lot of skills that we have. And I think we sometimes lose some of our confidence a little bit because other professions maybe appear to be more superior, more knowledgeable. But that's not the case. So stick with your gut, because your gut's often right. And then also, I really would suggest just to question the effectiveness of what you're doing regularly. Just look at, am I getting the results that I thought I would? And if not, why? And it's hard. We're exhausted. It's a tough job that we do. It really is. It's a tough job physically and emotionally and mentally. But, you know, we're changing kids' lives. We don't have the luxury of doing a, how can I say this without words that you'll have to cut out? We don't have the luxury of doing something halfway. Okay. And so question your effectiveness. And if you're not getting the results you want, then figure out a way to change it. And that might be talking to other people. But we've only got a short time with these kids before we've written the map of how they're going to be the majority of their lives.
Yeah, that's a good point. You brought up something that made me think you might have some good advice as well for people listening about dealing with other professions and convincing them about new approaches to therapy. I know there's a lot of orthopedic surgeons that sort of just tell parents, oh, if the orthotics are a waste of time, or if they're uncomfortable, don't worry about wearing them, you know, which is a half truth, really, because if the orthotics are uncomfortable, they need to be changed. Yes. But do you have any advice or any sort of go-to resources that you share with your doctors or orthopedic surgeons that you work with, or your orthotists, that people could use?
Yes. There is a paper written by Nancy Dilger, and I could get that up on my Facebook page or the website pretty easily. But Nancy was asked by our professional association to look at exactly the question, is toe walking a part of normal gait development? And it's not. And she finds many, many, many studies in this paper. It's a really interesting read. Many studies and research of normal gait where toe walking doesn't factor into it at all in the development. It's called Orthopedic Interventions for Pediatric Patients, The Evidence for Effectiveness. That was the study course, the home study course. And then her paper is Idiopathic Toe Walking, A Diagnosis of Exclusion or a Developmental Marker. So that's one thing that I do share. It's very in-depth. And so you get a lot of information yourself out of that. But whether a physician would read the whole thing, I don't know. And then I do try to talk to them about Wolf's Law and how bony modeling happens. And that's it. You know what I've found over the years to be effective is to type something that is literally bullet points, half a page long, and send it with the family to the doctor. Because something that's bullet points that stands out, they're not going to have to take a lot of time to read it. That can catch their attention. And, you know, and I think we have a responsibility as well. I I'm the first to throw doctors under the bus when it comes to this diagnosis, because I get very frustrated. You know, I know the changes that I can make, and the Botox, the surgery, the over-restrictive orthotics, just over 20 years, I just haven't seen them make a difference. And so, yeah, I'm the first to be critical. However, if the physicians are referring kids to us and we're not making positive changes, then after a while, we really can't blame them to not send the kids to therapy because, well, I tried that and it didn't work. So we got to, you know, why would we keep doing that? So we have a responsibility as well to increase our effectiveness and to increase the quality of our care. Again, it goes back to that. You can't complain unless you're part of the solution.
Right. So just to help out people who are wondering, which includes myself, if you were going to write bullet points to a doctor, what would you include in that? Would that be like your range of movement, your plan of treatment?
So glad you asked, Mindy. If you would, I have that already written. I think it's called an appeal to physicians, and is actually has been on Facebook page and my website page twice.
Right.
So it's on there, but let me look here if I can pull out a couple. Okay, here we go. I tell them toe walking as a part of normal childhood development is not well supported in the literature. That's one bullet point. Bony alignment, especially in the foot, is at a greater risk for deformities prior to the age of 4 due to ossification and Wolf's Law. Skeletal changes are less likely to respond to intervention after 4 years of age. Child's balance reactions and stability strategies are consistent, reliable, and predictable at the age of 3. Therefore, a walking pattern is much less likely to respond to intervention after that age. So we don't want to wait and see. Our potential for change when we realize at 3 or 4, oh, the toe walking's not going away, potential for change is a lot less. So mm-hmm. that last point there about the balance and stability strategies underlines the need and the necessity for intervention sooner rather than later. And I think finally, the other thing is that the toe walkers of 2 to 3 generations ago are different to the toe walkers of today. You know, we're just making kids differently now for a variety of reasons. That's a whole other podcast, I'm sure. But we're making kids differently now. And some of the docs, you know, remember that you could do stretches or you could do braces for 3-4 months and it improved them. But our kids are not like that now. They're a lot weaker than they were. They're a lot less active than they were. And neurologically, their brains are different than they used to be. So that's, oh, and equipment. They use a lot of equipment in the homes. You have the Johnny jump ups and the baby walkers and that kind of thing. So our kids have today that are toe walkers, I truly do believe that they are physiologically very different than they were 2-3 generations ago.
I will put links to those, all those things that you've mentioned on your website. Do you want to just let people know what your website is called and where to find you?
It is know as in knowledge. So K-N-O-W-T-O change. So no to change. You'll see a picture of me and my, and serendipity, me and the dog. You just brought it to my attention that there's not a link on the website to the Facebook page. That used to be there. So this is the problem. You don't know how to do technology. So I'll have to talk to my web guy and see where that was. But the Facebook page is also the same thing. No to change. And then we've got, what else? And this is not for me, but this seems to be helping clinicians. A step in the right direction is the Facebook page as well. And then I touch upon, since I'm unashamedly giving myself a plug.
Go for it.
Yeah, right. MedBridge has 2 courses already. And if you sign up or if you go to their page through my website and through my Facebook, I think you get a discount. But they have 2 on toe walking already, the sensory components of it. And then there's 2 more. One's going to be the development of the foot and one is core stability exercises. Those are coming out at the beginning of the year. And then day 3. Also, day 3 is through Education Resources, Inc. So that's where you can find all kinds of stuff.
That is amazingly helpful. Thank you for that.
Sure, thank you.